Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm one of the editors for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk to one of the authors of an original research article and the author of an accompanying editorial that appear in the June 2022 issue. With us today is Dr. Wade Weigel. Dr. Weigel is an anesthesiologist in the Department of Anesthesiology at Virginia Mason Franciscan Health in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Weigel is the senior author on an article that appears in the June 2022 issue of the journal, and it's titled Quantitative Neuromuscular Monitoring in Clinical Practice, a Professional Practice Change Initiative. Dr. Weigel, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you and for inviting me to participate in the podcast.
Also with us today is Dr. Megan Lane Fall. Dr. Lane Fall is David E. Longenecker, Associate Professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and Critical Care, and an Associate Professor in the Department of Biostatistics, Epidemiology, and Informatics at the Perelman School of Medicine in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Lane Fall authored an editorial that accompanies Dr. Weigel's original research article, and it also appears in the June 22 issue of the journal. It's titled, What Anesthesiology Has to Learn from Implementation Science and Quality Improvement. Dr. Lane Fall, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Rathmel. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Dr. Weigel, congratulations on publication of your study. Let's start with a little background about residual neuromuscular blockade. How common is residual blockade, and what are the associated risks?
The short answer is that it's more common than many people believe. Probably about 40% of our extubated patients remain partially paralyzed in recovery. Of course, neuromuscular blocker management will dictate the actual occurrence for a given individual provider or practice. As far as what does that mean, what are the associated risks, patients who don't breathe as deeply have a higher potential for longer PACU length of stay. They could have more pulmonary complications. They may actually have a longer stay in the hospital. There's some data to suggest there may even be increased mortality, though this would vary depending on the patient and the comorbidities.
Okay, so we know residual neuromuscular blockade is bad, and we know that residual blockade can be avoided by using quantitative neuromuscular monitoring. So why then don't all anesthesia providers use this approach?
That's an interesting question, and one that I've thought about a lot. I think first and foremost, many providers simply do not believe residual paralysis is a problem in their practice. Perhaps they do not see patients clearly unable to breathe in the recovery room. They believe residual paralysis is not present or that if present, it does not adversely affect the patients. Anesthesiology as a specialty is wonderful in the fact that it emphasizes patient safety. I believe if our colleagues really thought residual paralysis was occurring and harming patients, that they would move quickly to fix it. The second reason providers don't use quantitative monitoring may stem from a belief that using one drug, Sugammadex, solves the problem of residual paralysis. Sugammadex is a very effective drug, especially for deep levels of blockade, but I don't believe using a drug without monitoring is appropriate. I think of other monitors that we use in our daily practice, such as the blood pressure cuff, where we also have great drugs, vasopressors like epinephrine, but we always monitor to determine when and how much of the drug is needed, and then if the drug produced the desired effect. I think the same principle applies to neuromuscular blocker management. A third reason may be equipment acquisition and use. There's a cost to purchasing equipment, and there's a learning curve to using that equipment and getting this equipment and use into the workflow of administering an anesthetic.
All right, so we know change is hard, even when the scientific evidence clearly supports changes in clinical practice. Kudos to you and your colleagues. You set out on a professional practice initiative to attain documented train-of-four ratios greater than or equal to 0.9 in all patients. Tell us your study's original hypothesis and how you conducted the study.
Well, our goal was simple, to eliminate residual paralysis in our practice. We started with education about residual paralysis, and then we tested a few monitors to see which one our providers thought would work best in our practice. We intended to have only one monitor for simplicity, but due to feedback, we actually settled on two different monitors. We placed monitors in all anesthetizing locations. Next was the most important step, though, because we didn't rely on providers using their education to do the right thing. Instead, we set the expectation that all patients would attain a train-of-4 ratio greater than 0.9 before extubation, and that had to be documented on the anesthesia record. We then tracked compliance with this documentation. We contacted providers who did not document, first asked them if we missed the documentation on their record, then to ask why it was not done or documented. We always tried to focus on the good change we were trying to make, not on any failures. Our providers really care about their patients. I can tell you, after looking through over 2,000 anesthesia records, I could really see that in their documentation. I know they want to do the right thing for their patients.
So what were the results?
We reviewed individually 2,807 anesthesia records spanning 2016 to 2020. This was a time-consuming task, and we could not look at all the records. So what we did is we looked at about 200 records over a two-week period and did that for about every 6 months. Before the introduction of the monitors, we found that a recorded train-of-4 ratio greater than 0.9 occurred rarely, less than 2% of the time. We introduced monitors in October 2019, provided videos on how to use them in December 2019, and introduced automated alerts in our anesthesia record in June 2020. By December 2020, we had train-of-4 ratio greater than 0.9 documented in more than 93% of our cases. Over this same time period, 2016 to 2020, we also looked at the electronic charts of all patients receiving a non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocker. We compared patients pre-implementation, about 9,000, to patients post-implementation, which was about 4,000, and found shorter PACU length of stay, 2% overall, 7% inpatient, fewer pulmonary complications, a 42% reduction overall, 43% for inpatients, and shorter hospital length of stay, a median reduction of about 1 day.
Can you just elaborate on the pulmonary complication? What was the nature of those pulmonary complications?
Well, what we did is we looked at ICD codes to determine a composite of pulmonary complications. So it could be a pneumothorax, it could be an infectious process. There are a few studies done before ours where we utilized the same ICD codes that they did, looking for diagnoses that would indicate a pulmonary complication after surgery.
What were the limitations of your study?
Well, there were some limitations. The first limitation is that we don't have quantitative measurements in the recovery room. So in 2016, we didn't know the occurrence of residual paralysis in our practice. We had to assume that it was approximately 30 to 40% based on previous research, but we didn't have that number for our practice. Likewise, even at the end of our intervention, we don't have confirmatory measurements in the recovery room to accompany our pre-extubation measurements and documentation. Another limitation is our before-after statistical analysis. Ideally, we would have used an interrupted time series to show our intervention correlated in time with improved patient outcomes. Given the long implementation period, which was about a year and a half, we could not perform that analysis. Our results, therefore, show a correlation, but we must be mindful of the many contributing factors that may have influenced patient outcomes.
Well, what do you take away from the study? What did you conclude?
Well, first and foremost, we were able to improve our practice so that over 93% of our patients attained a train-of-4 ratio greater than 0.9 by December 2020. And that change in practice did correlate with reduced PACU length of stay, reduced pulmonary complications, and reduced hospital length of stay.
Were the improvements that you showed durable even after the study concluded?
Yes. I'll be honest, though. During 2021, when I was writing up the article and answering comments from anesthesiology, I didn't look at our dashboard for a few months, and I didn't send out reminder emails. I actually feared that we would lose ground, but I thought it was good to see if our changes were sustainable. When I looked, it was very gratifying to see that for 2021, we were hovering in the 95% range for documentation of train-of-4 ratios greater than 0.9. That's even more encouraging than it sounds, because when we compared our dashboard, and a dashboard is our electronically searched anesthesia records, which a feature that we did not have during the study, But when we looked at that dashboard and I compared it to manually searched records, there were always a few errors such that the dashboard would underestimate the actual compliance that we were attaining. Things like patients being transported to the ICU intubated, but being counted in the dashboard as being extubated. So the 95% is very good, but we may actually be doing better. And in more recent dashboard data, only a couple of months ago, we saw that we had 97% compliance, which is very exciting, meaning that we may very well be approaching our goal of 100%.
Dr. Lainfall, I want to turn to your editorial. You authored an editorial that accompanies Dr. Weigel's research article in the June 2022 issue of the journal, and it's titled, What Anesthesiology Has to Learn from Implementation Science and Quality Improvement. You do a terrific job of putting Dr. Weigel's article and the trial's design into perspective. Can you start by telling us about the origins of implementation science?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and thank you for the kind words. I was really excited to write this editorial and talk a little bit about something that's near and dear to my heart, which is implementation science, which is a scientific discipline that's concerned with improving the uptake of evidence-based practice. It's a field that is a hybrid field that most people would say is about 30 years old at this point. It draws from public health, draws from psychology, management, but really the origins are traced back to a sociologist, Everett Rogers, who, when he was doing some of his doctoral work, noticed that there were puzzling differences in the uptake of seeds that were used by farmers. And basically what he noticed was that as seeds evolved and seeds yielded higher crop yields and were more pest resistant, he would look around and think, why aren't farmers using these seeds? And he had to ask himself about the patterns of uptake of this new innovation, this new technology, and that really was the beginning of asking questions about why behavior changes or it doesn't. So that's really where I would put the origins, but it is a hybrid field that draws from a lot of different disciplines to try to understand behavior change in organizational context.
I'd like for you to point out some of the implementation strategies that Dr. Weigel and his team used that may have facilitated the adoption of the changes to clinical practice that they were trying to achieve.
Sure. So one of the tricky things about implementation science is that there are, at this point, more than 100 different strategies that we can use to change behavior. And those strategies can operate at the level of the individual, at the level of a team, or at the level of an organization. The strategies that Dr. Weigel and his team used, I would identify as a multifaceted implementation strategy, meaning that they used a package of different individual strategies to change behavior. I identified at least 8 strategies. There may have been more, but I'll walk you through what some of them were. The first is that they selected monitors that were based on feedback from clinicians. So they really were trying to understand the workflow of current clinicians and to engage them in the process. And that by itself is a strategy that can be helpful in changing behavior. The second is that they placed monitors in all the operating rooms. And so in doing, they restructured the clinical environment to make it easier for the clinicians to do the right thing. The third is that they developed educational videos to instruct clinicians, and we heard Dr. Weigel say that there was a little bit of education that was needed to help people understand the technology and how to use it appropriately. The fourth is that they selected a specific change target, and so there was something that everyone was driving toward, and so that helps with behavior change. The fifth is that they instituted automated alerts using a customizable clinician support system. And so those alerts served as reminders to clinicians as they were changing their behavior. The sixth, and my favorite, is that they included the neuromuscular blocker monitoring in their ongoing professional practice evaluation metrics. And so structurally, they encoded this change in the way that they evaluated the clinicians in their practice. The seventh is that they linked quantitative neuromuscular blocker monitoring to credentialing, which made it really, really salient and important to the clinicians to do this. And then the final one that I found, although there may have been more, was that they send department and individual email messages about performance. So it wasn't just, this is how we're doing. It was, this is how you are doing. And that is another way to get people to take a look at what they're doing and to continue to change their behavior in the expected direction.
Can you explain the difference between standard quality improvement initiatives and implementation science-informed approaches?
Yes, I'd be happy to. This is a question I get quite a lot as I teach implementation science and QI, and I'll give you the disclaimer that depending on when you ask me this question, I'll give you a different answer, but it's all sort of the same thrust. QI, or quality improvement, and implementation science are both focused on behavior change. They're both action-oriented fields. One of the main distinctions between them is that QI tends to be internally facing, meaning any given effort is meant to improve practice locally in the moment. Implementation science is usually externally facing, meaning it's trying to create generalizable knowledge for a large audience. You will find that quality improvement and implementation science use many similar techniques, and I would say over time that the fields are converging, but I think the primary distinction is who the primary audience is of each one. I'd also say that there are some decisions that have to be made for QI, and usually when you're deciding on how to conduct a project and how to measure, the focus is timeliness. When you're focusing on implementation science, you're trying to ensure rigor and internal validity. And so you may make decisions about measurement or about conducting a study that actually make it less timely or take a little bit longer or cost a little bit more or a little bit more intricate or involved. So I think some of the trade-offs that we make when we're doing projects are going to be different for QI versus implementation science.
In your editorial, you tell us that sustained changes like those lasting months to years may require different strategies over time to reach a goal performance target. Can you explain how the strategies for sustained change differ from those for getting early changes started?
It's relatively straightforward to change behavior in the short term. And anyone who's done quality improvement projects can tell you, you know, it's common to see a tick in the desired direction for the first month or two or three when there's a lot of enthusiasm about a project, when there may be a lot of attention or energy toward a project. But as that enthusiasm wanes and as that energy wanes, it's common to see regression back to the initial sort of level of performance. It's one of the reasons that when I review quality improvement papers for anesthesiology or for other journals, I'm looking for at least 6 months of data because there are so many projects that have had that initial change and then come back to that initial level of performance. Really, what we're looking for to see sustained change is transformation of the change into standard work. And so many of the strategies that Dr. Weigel and his team used helped facilitate the conversion of this practice initiative into standard work. And so the structural changes that I talked about, including the ongoing performance practice evaluation metrics, the moving monitors into every OR, the linking it to credentialing, those are measures that are going to keep this in place for a long time. And as we've heard from Dr. Weigel, it sounds like this is still very well ensconced in how they're doing their work.
Dr. Weigel, tell us what comes next for you and your research group.
Well, next for us is to make it even easier for our providers to document the train-to-per ratios by getting that data to transfer directly into our electronic anesthesia record. It's a great testament to our providers that they have worked so diligently to manually enter the information, but we would like the documentation to occur seamlessly into their busy workflow. Beyond that, we are interested in looking at our many patients who have been extubated with train-to-per ratios greater than 0.9 and see if the way they attain that reversal has any impact on patient outcome. We expect the attainment of return of strength is most important, but we want to know if it matters how that was accomplished by spontaneous recovery, neostigmine reversal, or Sugammadex reversal. So the idea is to look at patient outcomes for these three groups in a population where we know all the patients were fully reversed. Lastly, since we know that acceleromyography exaggerates the train-to-per ratio such that many advocate a cutoff ratio of 1.0, we'd like to design a study to verify that our pre-extubation acceleromyography train-to-per ratios of 0.9, which we use in our practice, is an adequate cutoff to ensure recovery room electromyography, which does not exaggerate the ratio, train-to-per ratio of 0.9.
Terrific. I hope today's discussion will lead many of you listening to read this new article and the accompanying editorial that appear in the June 2022 issue of Anesthesiology. where you can learn more about quantitative neuromuscular monitoring in clinical practice and the use of implementation science strategies to achieve durable changes in professional practice. Doctors Holly Andy and John Wanderer from Vanderbilt University also created an infographic titled Twitch Monitor to Choose, Quantitative Intraoperative Neuromuscular Monitoring, that summarizes the findings of this study. Dr. Weigel and Lane Fall, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanations.
Thank you, Dr. Rathmel, very much for allowing me to discuss our work. And thank you to Dr. Lane Fall for your insightful comments on our work and on process improvement in general.
Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about this really exciting work.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.